Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of a new book and a data dump of emails by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who was running for president in 2016 and has called himself the first e-governor because of the prolific use of his BlackBerry. Joining us is Matthew Corrigan, Chair and Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at the University of North Florida, who is the author of a new book just out, Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida. We will discuss Jeb Bush's record as a hardline conservative, which belies his latest public persona as a more moderate Republican, which ironically will help him in the general election, but hurt him in the Republican primaries, where polling of likely caucus goers indicates Bush is considered too moderate by 37% in Iowa and 41% in New Hampshire. Then we'll examine the brinksmanship going on between Greece and the so-called troika of creditors, the European Commission, the ECB, and the IMF, with senior officials in the just-elected Greek government who are saying they might look elsewhere to Russia and China for economic support, as Greece's new finance minister warns that the eurozone is a house of cards, that a Greek exit from the euro would collapse. Economist Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss what options Greece has and his article at Al Jazeera, Greece Needs an Exit Option. Then finally, we will speak with Carl Tobias, Chair and Professor of Law at the University of Richmond, who has tracked same-sex marriage across the country. We will look into the legal seesaw going on in Alabama with the state's Chief Justice Roy Moore ordering probate judges in all 67 counties not to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples in defiance of Monday's 7-2 decision from the U.S. Supreme Court to let a federal judge's order striking down the state's same-sex marriage ban take effect, causing confusion that has already led to the arrest of a female minister on the grounds of disorderly conduct for trying to perform a same-sex marriage in a judge's office. And joining us now is Matthew Corrigan, Chair and Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at the University of North Florida. He's the author of several books, including Race, Religion, and Economic Change in the Republican South and American Royalty, The Bush and Clinton Families, and The Danger to the American Presidency. His latest book just out is Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Corrigan.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And as it happens, Jeb Bush, who is clearly running for president and in many polls is ahead in terms of the 2016 Republican presidential candidates, quite a big field, but nevertheless, obviously it's early days. But a part of what is clearly his pre-announcement of being a candidate, he just released the first chapter of a new book that he's putting out, an e-book, and he also did a huge email dump of his time in the governorship in Florida, releasing many emails, by the way, that people are complaining about privacy issues. But so let's begin with that. I guess let's dismiss this idea that this guy's not running. I mean, it's pretty clear, right, that he's running.
Yeah, and frankly, I think you can say that about a lot of these candidates. The reason that they're not saying they're officially running is really for legal reasons. It seems to me all these people are, Senator Marco Rubio, but basically they're testing the waters, and if something terrible happened, okay, I guess they could pull out. But Jeb Bush has been to, is doing 60 fundraisers over the next couple of months. You don't do all of this. You don't release all these emails unless you're running for president.
And Jeb Bush calls himself the first e-governor. He's a man with a BlackBerry permanently in his palm of his hand, right?
Correct. He used email extensively, and what these emails have shown is how often he was on email. Now, Jeb Bush is a smart person, and he realized in Florida, the public records laws are very clear. Those were going to be public records, so it's not like you're getting really a peek behind the door because, he knew all along these would be made public.
So in terms of your new book, Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida, Matthew Corrigan, I guess is the general sort of thrust of it that Jeb Bush is, in terms of being a moderate, which is clearly a perception certainly not on the Republican right, but amongst the most of the country and the political center is, of course, where American presidents get elected. Is he a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Well, I think if you look at his record as governor, it's clearly a conservative one, and I give you a couple of quick examples. If you look at his social and cultural record, he ended affirmative action by executive order. He was very strong on gun rights. You had the famous Terri Schiavo intervention where he intervened really in a family matter about a woman who was in a vegetative state. He called himself probably the most pro-life governor of modern times. So a lot of people don't remember, his time as governor. It's been a while, but it was very conservative. And even his educational proposals, which have come under fire, really have had a conservative aim, and that is to increase choice. In other words, make public education much more like a typical market that people can choose and move around really quickly. And so, if you take his record in total as governor, it's clearly a conservative one.
Well, in some of these emails that Jeb Bush has released in conjunction with releasing the first chapter of a new e-book about his governorship, some of the emails cover a tremendous amount of communication from constituents, everything from religious parables to praising the governor for his support of creationism. So that's certainly something that liberals, I don't think, are totally aware of.
No, and I haven't heard the creation in terms of looking at not believing in evolution, but if you look at a number of those emails, and I haven't read all of them, I mean, there are literally hundreds of thousands of them, you can see the pressure that he got, especially from conservatives. If you look at the Schiavo case in particular, he got lots of pressure from conservatives to be more active in that case. I argued in my book that he went too far, because clearly the courts, time after time, including the Florida Supreme Court, basically said that this was a decision for the husband, that he had the legal standing to make the decision. But for some reason, it went through the Florida legislature, and then when the Florida Supreme Court said no, it went to Washington, it went to Congress, and then the President of the United States, his brother, flew in the middle of the night to sign the legislation, and then it got basically turned back by the federal courts. So when you look at all of those factors, it's probably a different record than what's being portrayed so far. But there is some important points to consider in terms of the Republican Party. With the emergence of the Tea Party since he's been governor, that movement makes a lot of people look more moderate, and I think Jeb Bush is caught in that right now. And also, Bush's tone is much more careful, I think, than he was when he was governor. Basically, when he was governor, it was my way or the highway. Although the emails do show another side, that he was a little bit more cordial to those who were disagreeing with him. He didn't do that a whole lot publicly in terms of some of his public statements. But since 2007, he's really put on a more measured tone in public. And I'll give you one example. The same-sex issue, same-sex marriage issue that has come up, it is now legal in Florida that a federal court has ruled the state constitutional initiative was going to be overturned. He said, he was still against same-sex marriage, but he wanted to be respectful of all sides. I don't really see him doing that 10 years ago. And so I think he has changed somewhat in his tone.
And again, I'm speaking with Matthew Corrigan, who's a chair and professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Florida. He's the author of several books, including Race, Religion, and Economic Change in the Republican South and American Royalty, The Bush and Clinton Families and the Danger to the American Presidency. And his latest book just out is Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida. So in terms of your earlier book, American Royalty, the Bush and Clinton Families and the Danger to the American Presidency, it is a little odd, isn't it, that here we are beating up on these peculiar North Koreans for their political dynasties, and here we are in the United States apparently having political dynasties, and in the 2016 presidency there, the bookies are basically, I think, all in agreement that it's likely to be a Clinton versus Bush run. What does it say about historical amnesia in the United States that the brother of the president who brought about this extraordinarily devastating Iraq misadventure that continues to cause us grief, along with crashing the global economy, could be electable?
Well, I think we all need to go back and look at the beginning of the country in terms of the Constitution, and a lot of those constitutional delegates were concerned about having a presidency to begin with, because again we were having a reaction to a king, a royalty. And so when you go back and look at some of those debates, in particular a delegate from Virginia, George Mason, was worried about an elective monarchy, and so I think there's some unique problems with combining presidencies with immediate families. You know, American politics is always going to have families, always going to have name recognition. That's going to be part of it. And, I don't think that's going to change. But when you talk about the office of the presidency and having these strong family connections, I think there are several problems. One, I think it's hard enough to be president without bringing family baggage into it. And just to give you a quick example, Bill Clinton was not impeached for some big policy issue. He was impeached because he either didn't want to tell his wife about an affair or didn't want to tell the country about an affair in a deposition. That was a very personal matter that impacted the presidency. And on the other side, the Bushes have to deal with the fact, is Jeb Bush going to say, George W. Bush was wrong in foreign policy on some things? Basically yesterday said, he's very proud of his brother, thought he's a great president, but are they going to agree on everything? And I think it's harder to come out publicly and say your brother or your father is wrong when, because of that relationship. And so I think there are some issues. And finally, the one that you brought up is, what message does it send to the rest of the world that supposedly the world's greatest democracy can only elect one of two families to the highest office?
Well, but I think a lot of political analysts suggest that the dynamics of a 2016 race between Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush would be thus, that Hillary Clinton is already being fairly conservative on foreign policy issues, and it's likely that she would move to the right to appear to be more hawkish than certainly Obama. And there's nobody running against her except Jim Webb, the former senator from Virginia, himself a Vietnam veteran, and he's extremely outspoken in his anti-war views, particularly in terms of the Iraq War. So that's not, I think, too much of a reach, that she may move to the right on foreign policy. So would therefore Jeb Bush sort of move to the left on domestic politics to be more user-friendly and distance himself from his brother?
Well, I think, at least in the Republican primary, and I don't think it's necessarily a sure thing that Jeb Bush wins the Republican nomination. I think he's going to be very competitive. As you've said, he's viewed as a moderate in some circles in the Republican Party. And those aren't the voters generally in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina that starts off the process. So it's going to be interesting to see how he does that. But I think his position on immigration reform is different from the rest of the Republican Party. And it's going to be a real test to see if, Republican primary voters are going to put up with that difference. And so I think that's really an issue to watch. And I think on other domestic issues, he's going to try to cast himself, and this is hard to do when you're the third person from the same family trying to get the presidency as an agent of change. In other words, he wants, and he did this in Florida, he looked at state government and he made a lot of procedural changes to how the government operated. And I think he's going to offer that as his calling card. I don't know if that's really moving to the left, but I think it's a message that he thinks is going to attract both Democrats and Republicans.
Well, I was meaning moving to the left after the primaries, assuming he gets by. And I think you're quite right, Matthew Corrigan, that it's not going to be easy for Jeb Bush to get through the Republican primaries. Already in Iowa, 37% of Iowa caucus goers see him as too moderate. Another 7% say he's too conservative. And in New Hampshire, the other important primary state, 41% of likely New Hampshire primary voters say Bush's pro-comprehensive immigration reform position and is a deal killer, and 20% say the same of his support of Common Core. That's from a Bloomberg poll. So he's already in trouble with his right, and I imagine equally so Hillary Clinton's going to be in trouble with her left. But you're not convinced he's going to get through that gauntlet, right? The right-wing Tea Party caucus.
I think it's going to be challenging. I think he's off to a good start in terms of raising money, in terms of endorsements. The question is in the primary voters, and I don't think we've got an answer to that yet. I think, you know, it's very early for polls, and another factor to all this, the two issues that he's attacked on the most in the Republican primary, or at least now, are education, Common Core, and immigration reform. Most of the people who may run against him don't have clear, hard right conservative views on both of those issues. Most of the governors who are thinking about running against him have elements of the Common Core curriculum in their states. Somebody like Rand Paul was pro-immigration reform, and so was Senator Marco Rubio. The only person I can really think of who was totally consistent and separate from Jeb Bush on those two issues is Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas. So it's really going to be a test in the Republican process whether you're going to have detailed policy discussions, because one probably understated factor with Governor Jeb Bush is that I think there is a higher ceiling for him. And what I mean by that is I think a lot of people outside of Florida are judging him by that last name. I think it helps him some, and I think it hurts him some. But he's a much different person than George W. Bush. He's a much more thoughtful person in a way. He's much more policy-oriented. And that may attract some people to him. But what he's not, he doesn't give a great stemwinder political speech. And so if people are looking for that, I think they're going to be disappointed.
Well, I would think, though, if Ted Cruz, who can't speak Spanish, starts going on criticizing Jeb Bush about his stand on immigration reform, all Jeb Bush has to do is get up on the stage with his wife, right? And that would be a pretty powerful message, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. This past week, he not only called himself bilingual, which he is, they speak Spanish at home because his wife is a Mexican immigrant, he called himself bicultural. And the reason for that is when Jeb Bush moved to Florida, he didn't move to my part of the state, which is in Jacksonville, which is the more conservative part, which in Florida, the more north you get, the more southern you get, if you will. And in other words, the northern part of the state is much more part of southern politics than the rest of the state. And he moved to Miami, which is a very diverse community, very immigrant friendly, and that's where he chose to begin his time in Florida politics. And I think that really helps determine his position on immigration reform.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Matthew Corrigan, talk about your book, Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida, and make the case that the book makes, which is that this is not a moderate Republican and by his record in Florida. He's quite conservative.
Yeah, the title of the book refers to his agenda, which was very conservative, and hurricane is a metaphor for he really enjoyed executive power. In Florida, since the end of the Civil War really was a weak governor state. Our structure had a very weak governor. When Bush came in, there were some constitutional changes. There was a Republican legislature. He had that last name. And he really swept through a comprehensive agenda, and most of it very, very conservative. I mentioned the cultural issues before. His educational initiative basically changed the way education was done in the state, in every public school in the state. He also had huge tax cuts. He also had huge incentives for businesses. He also privatized about a good portion of Florida government with very mixed results, but a lot of that privatization has held up over the test of time in terms of policies. He reclassified 16,000 civil service workers into positions where they could be let go much more easily. So it's a clear, comprehensive agenda, and it's going to be interesting to see when people look at it, will Republicans be more attracted to him, and will some Democrats and independents say, wait a second, this is not the person that we thought we were getting.
Well, just in closing, though, you were a consultant to Duval County, Florida, in terms of assisting county leaders in reforming the county's voting system, and we all know about the hanging chads. Where do we stand in terms of Florida's vote being secure?
It's much better. It's still not perfect. Our system, and this really comes from the Civil War as well, allows the counties to really run their own election system. And so it could be better, but it's much better than the hanging chads. We don't have the chads anymore. We have a Scantron system, which works much better. We have a better system when you have a dispute if the machine does not register a vote. So it's a much better system, but, you know, Florida is still Florida, and we've had problems in Miami-Dade County, for instance, because ballots in different languages weren't printed, and there were long lines on election day. So it's still not perfect, but it is a lot better than 2000. That was a complete mess. There's no question about that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Matthew Corrigan.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Corrigan, who's chair and professor of political science and public administration at the University of North Florida. He's the author of several books, including Race, Religion, and Economic Change in the Republican South and American Royalty, The Bush and Clinton Families, and The Danger to the American Presidency. His latest book just out is Conservative Hurricane, How Jeb Bush Remade Florida. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the brinksmanship going on between Greece and the so-called Troika of creditors. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who co-directs the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his books include False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. He has an article at Al Jazeera, Greece Needs an Exit Option. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And as your article points out, that in the free market economy, if you don't like your breakfast cereal, you can switch to another brand. And if your barber's charging you too much for a haircut, you can go somewhere else. Now, Greece is, of course, toying with that option. But recently, Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Fed, said that the Greece's exit from the Eurozone was all but inevitable. The rather combative new foreign minister of Greece on Italian television said that the Eurozone is a house of cards, and if Greece pulls out, there'll be a contagion effect. So this feels a little bit like a game of chicken that's going on here. How do you see it?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, essentially, Greece's position is they need some relief from the austerity that the European Union's imposed on them for the last 4 years. This has really just devastated its economy. I think it's hard for people to appreciate, you know, certainly in the United States, to the extent to which its economy has contracted, the misery. Their GDP's fallen by about 23% since its pre-crisis levels. And by frame of reference, U.S. GDP at the bottom of the Great Recession, I'm sorry, Great Depression, so this is the 30s, not the last decade, was down by 26%. And we, of course, bounced back from that. So that was in 1933, and we bounced back by 10% the following year. So they're looking at something that's much deeper and longer lasting than what we experienced in the Great Depression. Their unemployment rate's 25%, youth unemployment's over 50. And the worst part of the story is there's no one who expects a big turnaround. So, you know, the argument is their economy's growing. It did grow a little bit, like 0.5% last year. Maybe it'll do a little bit better this year. But you're talking about decades until they get back to where they were back in 2007. So they're in a horrible situation. They're asking for some relief. And the question is whether the European Union, here really the key actors, Germany, is prepared to do it. And, you know, their line has been no, 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 you just have to have more of the same. And the Greek government is saying we're not going to accept that. So that's the game of chicken. Does, you know, does at the end of the day, Greek government go, okay, you know, I guess we have to live with this? Or do they say, okay, if you're not going to let us have any room, we're leaving? And then at that point, maybe the European Union reconsiders. So that's kind of where we are.
Well, on the political front, of course, Greece's defense minister, who is the junior partner in the coalition, he's the head of the Independent Greeks, which is a nationalist anti-bailout party on the right, as a matter of fact, in coalition with the leftist Syriza party. He said on Greek television that we should be looking for other sources of help. It could be the United States at best. It could be Russia. It could be China or other countries. And added to that, the deputy foreign minister of Greece said on Greek radio that Russia and China had already offered Greece economic support. And he is heading to Moscow. He's due to visit Russia on Wednesday. So this, again, is Greece exercising some leverage, or do you think? I'd be surprised. Russia doesn't seem to be in a good economic shape. I don't know what kind of money they can lend. And China, what would be in it for the Chinese?
Well, Russia does have reserves, but, you know, my guess is they'll be kind of hesitant to make any really big commitments to Greece, but they certainly could help. China, you know, I think from China's vantage point, you know, it's a rapidly growing economy. It's, by some measures, already passed the U.S. as the largest economy in the world. I could see them seeing an opportunity to you know, extend their influence. I don't think there's anything overly pernicious. I mean, I don't think they're going to be looking to have Greece be a colony, but I think they, you know, they could see it as an opportunity, saying, okay, if you know, the European Union is not being, you know, treating the Greek people in a way they consider acceptable, we'll give them an alternative. So I could see them finding it worth their while to do that. I don't think it would take a huge commitment on their part, because at this point, Greece has had so much austerity, its economy has contracted so much, it now has a primary budget surplus. That means if it weren't for the interest payments, they would have a surplus. And on current account, you know, their trade deficit, they have a surplus in that as well. So I don't think, you know, we'd be talking about some massive amount of money from China. And, of course, even a massive amount of money for Greece is really a drop in the bucket for China. So I can well imagine them coming to Greece's assistance.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest article at Al Jazeera is Greece Needs an Exit Option. So in terms of, though, this contagion that the new Greek finance minister has warned about, suggesting that, in effect, that Greece has some leverage over Germany, because if they pull out, you know, he said on Italian television that the Eurozone is a house of cards, which I suppose means that maybe Spain would follow and then perhaps Italy. Walk us through that, Dean. Is there any truth to that speculation?
Well, I think very much so. Greece has suffered the most of any of the European countries since the collapse, but Spain also has high double-digit unemployment. I haven't seen the latest numbers, but they had been over 20%, not quite as high as Greece, but they had been very high. Again, also suffering enormous contraction, not quite as much as Greece, but certainly very steep by any measure. Again, with little prospect of any sort of rapid turnaround. Italy, not quite as bad, but they've had near zero growth negative growth for much of the last 4 years. They're not looking at any robust recovery. So if you had a story where Greece left the euro and its economy turned around, and I think that's actually a very, very plausible story, which I'll explain in a second, I could well imagine there being pressure on the other countries, Spain and Italy, Portugal, the other countries that have been hit with austerity by the had austerity imposed on them, I should say, by the European Union, to leave the euro. The reason why I was saying Greece may be able to turn around quickly is the result of leaving the euro is that its currency would have a much lower value, and that has a big advantage in trade, in that suddenly it'd be very cheap for people to travel to Greece as tourists or to buy Greek products, and in effect, it would suddenly become hyper-competitive. That's really what it needs to do. It does need, in effect, something like a devaluation. That's what would have happened in the pre-euro days, but now that they're on the euro, they don't have that as an option. So absent a policy coming from the rest of the eurozone to accommodate Greek situation, really higher inflation elsewhere, there isn't a way for them to adjust, or certainly not easily. But if they were to leave the eurozone, they suddenly would become very competitive. They'd see a huge increase in their trade surplus. And I could well imagine that would be a story that, in Spain, in Portugal, Italy, people are going to look at and say, why don't we go the same way?
So what are the consequences, though, for the Greeks themselves, Dean Baker? My understanding is that going out of the eurozone and returning to the drachma would have a devastating effect on wages and pensions and that perhaps explains why, in polling, the Greek people want to stay in the eurozone. I think a substantial majority want to stay in the eurozone.
Well, there's two things. I mean, the short-term story is undoubtedly a bad one in the sense that the immediate aftermath of of Greece leaving the euro, particularly if it's a break-off rather than an orderly departure, a negotiated departure with Germany and the other eurozone countries, there'd almost certainly be a financial panic, run on banks. This would really be, chaos for, some period of time. Well, I'm saying some period of time, weeks, possibly a month, perhaps longer. But I think in a longer period of time, 3 months, 6 months, I would presume they would have their finances worked out. I mean, this has been done in other cases, and so it's not like this is uncharted water. It's uncharted water with the euro, but other countries have broken off from currency unions or become independent, and that can be done. The question is, how does that look? And in terms of the pensions, that will to a large extent be up to the Greek government. I would imagine they would look to make sure that people's pensions are paid. Again, before I was saying that the government actually has a primary budget surplus. That means if they're not paying interest, they have more than enough to meet their obligations. And they have a current account surplus, which will get larger when the currency falls. But they have a current account surplus, which means that they don't have to borrow from any other country to meet their obligations, pay for their imports. So I think they can get through that fairly quickly. And, I would expect that the government would place a very high priority ensuring that if pensions aren't paid 100 cents on the dollar, something pretty close to it.
Well, apparently already the only sort of good economic sign in Greece is, of course, the plunge in oil prices, which saved Greece up to $9 billion a year, which is, in your article, Al Jazeera, Greece needs an exit option, Dean Baker, you said, is close to 4% of its GDP. But still, it would seem that if let's use the analogy of the individual who goes bankrupt and owes a creditor a lot of money, wouldn't that make it hard for Greece to borrow on the credit market?
Well, this is the point. They wouldn't really need to. Since they have a primary budget surplus, if they're not making the interest payments on their debt, which at least for a period of time, presumably they won't be. I mean, they'll presumably work something out over time, but at least in the immediate aftermath of leaving the euro, presumably they're not making their interest payments on the debt. So they don't have to borrow in international markets. At some point, they'll presumably want that option. They might need it at some point. But the immediate period after they leave the euro, they're not going to need to borrow in international markets. So I don't doubt it would be difficult for them, but, you know, again, they wouldn't need to do that, so they'd be in a position that they can get by without borrowing, at least for a period of time.
Well, there's no question that when both the leader of Syriza, the new Prime Minister, Alex Tsipras, and the new Finance Minister say that the only winners so far in the European austerity movement, largely generated by Germany, are right-wing neo-fascist parties in Europe, where in France, for example, Le Pen's right-wing nationalist party probably, at this point, if you polled, have more popularity than Hollande, the current president. So this is a really toxic phenomenon that's developing. But on the other hand, you know, with Greece flirting with Russia and already showing signs that they may join in Russia's sort of Ukraine position, which is clearly opposed by most of Europe except Hungary. And of course, we know that Putin has been funding a lot of these right-wing European parties. So there's something quite nasty going on in Europe with Russians funding right-wing parties, which I'm not entirely, I haven't really looked into thoroughly, but on the surface it sounds a little unpleasant, shall we say. So I guess two questions. One is, are neo-Nazi parties the real beneficiaries of austerity? And two, is Greece getting into dangerous waters playing the Russian card?
Well, the first question, people are going to look for parties that offer them answers. And if the center parties, and this is certainly the case in Greece, if all they could say is more of the same, that's not going to make sense. I mean, people's lives are being ruined. So, you know, you're voting for people for office and they're just going, oh, well, we have to have more of the same. And one of the things that was striking in the most recent election, where Syriza won in Greece, the traditional Social Democratic Party, PASOK, barely got into parliament. I think they got like 4% of the vote. This is a party that was the ruling party just like 4 years ago. And they almost fell out of existence, or at least lost any presence in parliament. And that's because they have nothing to say. All they're telling people is more of the same. And that's what you're seeing across Europe. And, you know, again, in France, Le Pen is talking about leaving the euro. Well, that's, if you can't get away from austerity within the euro, that's actually a reasonable policy, which is not to endorse anything else, she says, in terms of immigration and racist attitudes. But that's actually a reasonable policy. So if the mainstream parties, including the Social Democratic parties, are saying, oh, well, all we have for you is austerity, well, that's not acceptable to people. This is ruining people's lives. So, yeah, you are going to see this move, you know, to some extent, obviously, in Greece you're seeing it to the left, in Spain you're seeing it to the left, but if there's not a left presence, you will see people on the right who appeal to that anger, to that disenfranchisement. As far as Russia, I really can't speak to that. I mean, obviously Putin is looking to expand his influence, how successful, how much money, how much he could succeed in doing that by supporting these right-wing parties. I really have no idea. I mean, all I could say is that he has very fertile ground in a context where Eurozone countries have austerity imposed on them.
But in terms of playing the Russian card, clearly that would backfire with the United States. So what interest does the U.S. have in Greece, do you think, apart from the fact that it's a NATO member?
Well, I don't know that it backfires with the United States. It might well be the thing that prompts President Obama to get on the phone and talk with Chancellor Merkel, you know, as the head of the government in Germany, and say, hey, why don't you play ball here? Because there's no reason Germany, the Eurozone, can't make the concessions that the Greek government's requesting. I mean, these are not, they're not asking for a handout. It's important for people to understand. They're paying money to the Eurozone right now, and their position is, we want to pay less money. And that should be an acceptable, you know, one will quibble over where that will come down and everything, but that proposition should be acceptable to the Germans first and foremost, but the rest of the Eurozone.
So this is, I guess, similar to what happened with after the 2008 crash here. There were, you know, attempts to have the banks relent. And these, after all, the banks and the large Wall Street banks were the ones that caused the 2008 crash. and yet there were tremendous efforts made to keep people in their homes, not to throw them into the street. They are still prepared to service these debts, but these debts were so unreasonable that the banks, by and large, did not play ball. So what is the mentality of bankers that don't want to receive some servicing on the debt until the homeowner gets back on their feet and then can pay more? But they, you know, they force the default.
Well, there's a couple things I would say going on here. One, I think that's clearly important is the ideology that, you know, you have this, you know, the Greeks were, this is how they're portraying it, you know, certainly in Germany and, you know, probably elsewhere in Northern Europe, that, you know, the Greeks were irresponsible spenders and, you know, they have corruption and they just can't be trusted and, you know, we really have to lay down the law. So that's just like, you know, we're going to teach them to be responsible. So I think that there's an ideological element. There is also a push that many of the specifics of the bailout agreement required changes in labor market institutions. Like they had to cut back their minimum wage hugely in Greece. They've had to cut back employment protections. You know, all these things are things one could argue over, but those are sort of things that ordinarily are left to domestic policymakers, not imposed from outside. But if you see this as we want to, you know, discipline Greek workers, the, you know, we want the Greek labor market opened up for foreign investment, then it's a chance to force that. So I think you do have some people who see it that way. So I don't consider that unimportant. I mean, frankly, I think the ideology aspect probably is more important. Just having spoken to some people in policy positions in Germany, invariably they, you know, just get, you know, frustrated, disgusted, you know, the Greeks don't live like us. They don't, you know, they don't keep books like us. And I actually think that's a deeper issue, although clearly there are many who, you know, see this as an opportunity. You know, we're going to take, you know, hugely cut their minimum wage, rewrite their labor laws.
Well, just in closing, Dean Baker, is there an analogy here historically with Argentina?
Yeah, well, I think that would be the positive one. Argentina, for people who don't remember, they'd had a very economically orthodox government. They had tied their currency to the dollar, imposed austerity on their country, and they had a very severe downturn beginning 98, I believe, and it just kept getting worse and worse. And finally, in December 2001, they were no longer in a position to meet the demands from the International Monetary Fund. They ended up essentially defaulting on their debt. They broke the link to the dollar. And the positive start of the story, there was chaos there. They had 2 or 3 months. People couldn't get their money out of the banks. And, you know, things, you know, they were really doing it all on a fly. But by the summer of 2002, their economy had stabilized. And by the fall, it was growing very rapidly. And it continued to grow very rapidly for the next 7 years, right until the world recession hit in 2008, 2009. So that, I think, is a comparable situation, and certainly if Greece could do as well as Argentina did in that period, that would be a very good move for them. Now, more recently, Argentina has had problems, but I don't see that as being directly connected. They've clearly made some policy mistakes in the last few years, but I think that was definitely the right thing for the country to do at the time, and their economy really did bounce back with benefits for most of the population in the years following.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his books include False Prophets, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. He has an article at Al Jazeera, Greece Needs an Exit Option. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into confusion over same-sex marriage in the state of Alabama. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carl Tobias, who's the Chair and Professor of Law at the University of Richmond. He writes on a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection, and he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Tobias.
Thank you.
And I don't know how you're tracking what's going on in Alabama, Carl. It's been such a to and fro on the gay marriage issue, with the Supreme Court stepping in, the federal court stepping in, then Roy Moore, the Alabama's Supreme Court Chief Justice, stepping in and telling judges to not to recognize same-sex marriage, even jailing somebody that tried to do so. What's going on?
Well, it's a long story, but about 10 days ago, the federal district judge in the Southern District of Alabama invalidated the ban on same-sex marriage, and she stayed her ruling until yesterday so that the Attorney General could appeal, and the Attorney General then sought a stay and appeal to the 11th Circuit, the appeals court in which Alabama is situated. That court denied the stay, and then the Attorney General appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which also denied the stay yesterday, and so lifted the stay at that point, and people could be married. However, the Chief Justice Moore instructed the probate judges who issue licenses not to do so, and that's what has caused some of the problems and issues in Alabama about getting married.
So, but this has echoes, doesn't not, Carl, of the going back through the civil rights struggle with Governor George Wallace of Alabama defying federal authorities. How far in terms of a deja vu are we in that regard?
Well, some people do make that comparison, and there are some analogies. Hopefully we won't get to that point. But at some point, if that were to happen, and if there's open defiance by state officials of federal law and federal judges' rulings, at some point the Supremacy Clause in the Constitution would apply, and the state officials will need to comply with federal court orders. Hopefully we won't get to that point, and I don't think we're there yet, but we'll see. The judge who ruled originally on Thursday will have a hearing at which the probate judges, or at least one of them, who won't issue licenses, will, I think, make his arguments, and then I think she'll rule, and hopefully that will provide more clarity.
Well, apparently a female minister was arrested after offering to perform a same-sex marriage at a judge's office. She's been charged with disorderly conduct after refusing to leave. So obviously there's some defiance going on. And I imagine for same-sex couples in Alabama, the situation is confusing, perhaps even torturous.
Well, I think that probably is true, and I think we tend to forget the human dimension involved in these cases. And I've heard people say, well, why don't we just wait till the Supreme Court rules on the merits in June? But that's a long time from now for people who want to get married. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that the legal situation will sort itself out in short order in Alabama, and then people will be able to be married. And I do believe in the some of the larger areas, which cover about half the population, that judges are issuing licenses. And so that's a possibility for a number of people.
So some judges in Alabama are defying the Chief Justice, Roy Moore?
Yes, apparently that's the case. And I think mostly in the larger cities like Huntsville and Montgomery, they are issuing licenses, and people are able to get married.
But it seems that the Chief Justice Roy Moore, and we know his history of wanting to put the Ten Commandments in front of the State House, etc., that he is motivated by religion and as such is probably pretty inflexible. In fact, he's described homosexuality as an inherent evil. So what does it take to change the mind of somebody that appears to be a religious zealot in this regard?
Well, it may require a federal court order, but these are very delicate matters between the state and federal judiciaries. And so I think everybody is trying to treat this in a gingerly fashion and to try to resolve it in the way that will allow for amicable relations between the different judiciaries at the federal and state level. There's a notion called comity, and the judiciaries try to work together, but they can't always do that. This is the first time I think we've seen it in the same-sex marriage litigation. There have been coordinate state actions that have gone along at the same time as the federal ones, but I think almost all the state court judges have just deferred to the federal judiciary in this regard, but not so in Alabama.
And again, I'm speaking with Carl Tobias, who's the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond. He writes on a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selections, and he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. We're talking about the to and fro going on in Alabama, where the Alabama Supreme Court Justice, the head of the Alabama Supreme Court, Judge Roy Moore, appears to be defying federal authority. Now, the Supreme Court, though, seems to be pretty clear on this, and there's an expectation that their later ruling will basically put this issue to rest. And even Justice Thomas sort of threw in the towel recently by indicating that he expected the ruling to go that way. I think the last ruling from the Supreme Court in terms of overturning the Alabama courts was a 7-2 ruling, wasn't it?
Well, we don't know exactly. All we know is there were two dissents, but probably the seven justices who did not issue an opinion would have voted the other way. We don't have a record of that. I think that's likely, though. And I think what you just said is true, which goes back really into the denial of appeals from the 4th, 7th, and 10th Circuit, which happened on October 6th. At that point, I think it became pretty clear where the Supreme Court might go, because I don't think it would have rejected those appeals and then let tens of thousands of people be married only to issue a final ruling on the merits in June in which the court said, no, we're not in favor of marriage equality. Because that just wouldn't be appropriate, and it would really cause legal confusion, even though I think ultimately anyone married in that situation I described is going to have their marriages recognized. So that's a long way around of saying it does appear that the Supreme Court will rule in favor of marriage equality, but you never know until the court actually finally decides.
Well, there is a precedent, though, for that whipsawing of same-sex marriage couples who get married and then suddenly find that their marriages are not being recognized. We had Proposition 8 here in California, and of course it was eventually overturned. So, but what's your sense, though, of what's going on at the Supreme Court? I was struck recently by Linda Greenhouse, a longtime court observer, who's always deferred to the majesty, if you will, of the court. She wrote a very heartfelt piece recently suggesting that she's beginning to wonder whether these conservative justices are not simply political operatives in robes, or Republican political operatives in robes. And so could it be possible that if she's right in her disquiet about the direction of the court, that the getting rid of this by overturning the ban on gay marriage and settling this issue, in effect, it gets the Republicans off the hook in the upcoming election, that they can always say, well, I'm against gay marriage, but, you know, I can't argue with the Supreme Court. It's the final word.
Well, there may be some truth to that. It may take away that issue as an election issue, but we'll see what the court does. Hard to know. She's certainly a longtime respected observer of the court and an astute observer at that. So we'll see. It should be interesting, but it does seem like the court will decide it this term, and barring any procedural technicalities or anything of that sort, I think it will probably be fully reviewed.
So in terms of where same-sex marriage couples stand in Alabama, what can one say to these people who, I mean, you see pictures of people showing up, you know, in their, you know, wedding dresses and their best suits, and, you know, you can't help feeling empathy for the idea that, the authorities are playing with these people's lives.
Well, that is terribly unfortunate, but this is one of the prices of a federal state system to some extent, and that's why I think the judge Grenad, the district judge who ruled and invalidated the ban, is trying to move quickly and carefully and fairly to some resolution by holding a hearing on Thursday, at which hopefully she'll be able to sort out these legal issues and perhaps break the logjam to the extent that some judges are not willing to issue licenses. That's my hope, and I think then maybe it would clarify and people would be able to get married throughout much of the state.
But do you think at the end of the day, Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore is going to accept the federal ruling, which would likely go against him?
Well, I don't know, but I think we at least have the sign, as I suggested, that a number of the judges have not followed his order. And I think in the days ahead, depending on how the district judge rules, there may be further erosion, if you will. And at some point, I think maybe a substantial percentage of the probate judges will be willing to issue licenses. And it may take some time, but I'm hopeful that if she rules on Thursday in favor of plaintiffs, that there'll be more defections by the judges, and the momentum hopefully would build for all of them to go ahead and issue licenses.
But can he fire these judges for defying his orders?
I don't think so. I don't know exactly what kind of authority he has over them. It may be a kind of administrative authority, but they are elected officials, as he is. And so it really is, I think, up to the local voters where each of these judges sit to decide the fate of the judges when they're up for re-election. So I don't believe he can do that.
Well, Carl Tobias, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Carl Tobias, who is the chair and professor of law at the University of Richmond, who writes in a number of areas with a particular emphasis on federal judicial selection, and he has tracked same-sex marriage litigation across the country. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll